New numbers from Wisconsin's health department show fewer Wisconsin students were fully immunized last school year. Immunizations help protect people from disease in two ways. Vaccines help people individually avoid illness, and then there's herd immunity. Without sick people spreading disease around, someone who can't get a vaccine is less likely to encounter the disease, so they're also less likely to catch it. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Immunization rates are trending down in Wisconsin, and state leaders are trying to figure out what to do about it. What do you think contributes to declining immunization rates? Are you someone who can't get vaccines? Maybe your child or your parent has a health condition that prevents them from being immunized. What do you want people to know? 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Stephanie Schauer is the director of the immunization program for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Stephanie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
So we know in the last school year, students who met those minimum immunization requirements fell. It's 0.4%. So how significant is that really?
Yeah, so, you know, I just want to say, first off, it is the norm for children to be vaccinated. And as you said, about 92% of children in Wisconsin schools are fully immunized. But we know about 1.1% of children are completely unvaccinated. And we are concerned that there's a segment of the population that has been slowly growing over the last 20 years that is not protected, and concerned about what risks that opens up for the community. Even though it sounds like a small number, it is concerning when you have a number of individuals in a particular community that are unprotected.
And it sounds like that small number is compounding then. So if it's just kind of these tiny little steps over the last two decades, it becomes a bigger problem than just a difference in 1 year.
Exactly. And, you know, I think one example, unfortunately, that we have this year of where sort of mounting increases in those that are not protected in the community is the measles outbreak that we've seen nationally. And that's really in a number of different instances. It has started with one unprotected individual traveling overseas. They are exposed to measles, and they return to the community where individuals are not protected. And that individual gets sick, and then the disease is able to spread. And unfortunately, with measles, you need a very high level of protection in the community for that not to happen. And that's really the concern, is if you have a school community or a section of a city, for example, where you have a higher number of unprotected individuals, that's the kind of things that we are concerned about happening.
You mentioned measles. My understanding is that for herd immunity for diseases like measles, you need a number of about 95% fully vaccinated. Wisconsin's at just under 92%. So that difference could be significant.
Correct. You know, 95 is a very high number. Measles is one of the most infectious diseases, so that's a pretty high bar. It's hard to get a community up to that level, but we certainly are trying to make strides in making sure that every individual who can be protected certainly is. I think one of the things that we're wanting to make sure is that parents know that there is the Vaccines for Children program, which is really a key component in helping assure access to vaccines. And in brief, what this does is it allows children who are uninsured, on Medicaid, who are Alaska Native or American Indian, to receive vaccines at little or no cost at a health care provider or a local health department. So it's really important, if people are seeing cost as being a barrier to having their children vaccinated, that they get more information about that program and that is available on the DHS website.
We're talking with Stephanie Schauer. She's the director of the immunization program for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. I'm Keely Boltina, and we still have time for you to weigh in. How can Wisconsin encourage more people to vaccinate against these serious diseases? Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Stephanie, let's step back and look at the numbers we're dealing with. We're talking about the number of students who meet the minimum immunization requirements. What does that mean?
Right. So that means that the students have received all of the vaccines that are required by Wisconsin law, and so they have everything that is needed. Now, we do have a certain percent of of individuals who have a waiver. And I just want to make it clear that someone may have a waiver, but they may not be missing all vaccines. They may be missing just one or two. But it is still important that that we make sure that we work to ensure that everyone is as fully vaccinated as we can be.
You mentioned the waivers. Wisconsin is one of 15 states that allows a personal conviction waiver. So that allows parents to opt out of vaccines for those children. And those waivers are different. They're not based on religious beliefs. So what is the state health department's stance on personal conviction waivers?
Yeah, so, you know, as you said, we are one of 15 states that does have the waivers. And it is certainly something that Wisconsin is not alone in having, and with this discussion about waivers, it is certainly part of the law. And so in Wisconsin, we continue to accept those waivers, which, once again, are the medical waivers, religious waivers, and the personal conviction.
And there are times that different lawmakers are considering changing that personal conviction waiver, even eliminating it. So if the law were to change, the health department would flex with the law?
Yes, yes. I mean, we go ahead and follow the Wisconsin law as set. And so that really is a job for lawmakers, and we'll just have to wait and see how that bill makes it through. You know, a number of states where similar types of legislation has been introduced this year, and I think it's in part response to the measles outbreak. And some have been successful, such as Washington, and some have not. So it really varies across the U.S. How people are feeling. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens here in Wisconsin.
Do we know how much of this this problem with people being un or under vaccinated is directly related to that personal conviction waiver, as opposed to other factors like access to primary care physicians or pharmacies that could provide those vaccines? Can we draw that line?
Yeah, you know, we don't know why someone will claim a personal conviction waiver. That information is not collected. But, you know, we do hope that if parents have questions about vaccines, that they talk with their, you know, trusted healthcare provider or doctor to get the information that they need. There is a lot of information out there and misinformation, and it's important that parents have the right information to make those decisions and that they hopefully will make the decision to vaccinate. So we want people to feel reassured that vaccines are safe and effective, and it's important that they talk with a trusted source, such as a healthcare provider.
Stephanie, are there parts of the state or certain populations that have lower vaccination rates or may have contributed more to this decrease?
Yeah, you know, it really varies across the state. If you look at the map sort of county by county, it's sort of up and down, and it's really, I think, more important even at a more granular level is that disease really is transmitted locally. So it's not even at the county level, but it may be at a particular community level. And we even know that within a given district or community that schools can vary in the rates. And so in terms of having more children protected or less children. And so we're trying to provide that information to healthcare providers and local public health so that everybody can work together and focus efforts on the areas where there are lower rates, because that's where you're going to see the disease transmission. We know that schools, for example, are a great place for some diseases like influenza to sort of be transmitted. So thinking about it on a really local level, it's important to think about the community where you live and go to school and shop, et cetera.
Stephanie, thank you for bringing us up to speed on this.
Great. Thank you.
Stephanie Schauer is the director of the immunization program for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and we've been talking about immunization rates in Wisconsin schools. Up next, we have a conversation about losing a pet. Maybe you've been there. What advice do you have? Let's talk about your pet, their name, their story, and how you dealt with the loss. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. This is the Ideas Network, and you're listening to The Morning Show. Pets bring wonder and love into our lives. They're something to care for. They can offer security. They provide us a relationship without conditions. Our dogs or birds, guinea pigs and cats, they're not critiquing us. Okay, well, maybe cats are. But they just want to be fed and loved. And so when that relationship goes away, when a pet dies, it can be devastating. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we're talking about how we grieve when we lose a much-loved pet, and that's really only possible with you. So have you had a pet who died? What was their name? How did you deal with the loss? And have you ever had to put your pet to sleep? What do you remember about those final moments with your pet? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. Dr. Julia Bates is a veterinarian. She's board certified in small animal internal medicine and practices at Madison Veterinary Specialists. Dr. Bates, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so why are pets so special to us? What is it about them?
Well, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. I mean, they're such unconditional friends or family members. You know, they rely on us every day for food and exercise and all of those things. So they become such a constant companion that, you know, they're there. And so that loss is often pretty big when it happens, because a big part of your life, your routine, is often gone. Not only the love of the pet, but, you know, that routine is changed significantly, and that can affect people pretty heartily.
Yeah. Some people say that losing their pets, you know, hurt more than losing another human being. Do you hear that? Do you see that?
I do. I mean, I see, you know, certainly, you know, people are devastated by the loss of a pet. I mean, pets are living much longer now than they used to. And so, you know, you have these pets that have been around for 15, you know, in some cases, even 20 years as a cat. And that's sometimes more than, you know, half of people's lives. And they've had relationships come and go during that period of time. But, you know, that pet has been there with them. And they may not have a lot of family members. You know, they may be an older person who, you know, doesn't have a lot of people in their lives. And so, you know, again, those pets are constant companions. They're there day in and day out. And, you know, like you said, they're not judging you. They're just loving you.
Right. Yeah. Do you think grieving pets is similar to grieving other loved ones? Are there differences that, you know, you obviously see?
I think it depends on the person. Yeah. I think it's a very individual thing. You know, having lost family members, I mean, those were devastating. And having lost pets, I mean, for me personally, it was equally as devastating. But certainly, I can't say that it's a general rule.
Certainly. A friend of mine actually posted on Facebook just yesterday. He writes, I had to say goodbye to my singing dog friend, Ricardo. I got him as a rescue when he was 9 years old. He was a great fellow, and he loved to sing to the Matlock theme. Ricardo, you'll be missed. These are the stories we tell about our pets.
Yeah, I mean, and they're so true. I mean, you can see them, you know, all the time. And, you know, it's just, I'm humbled that, you know, I get to work in a profession where people care about their animals so much.
Yeah. Dr. Julia Bates is a board certified veterinarian. She works with small animal internal medicine. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Did you have a pet die as a child? Did your family take on the situation in a certain way? What do you remember about it? Maybe you have a pet now. How do you plan to handle that pet dying differently? Email ideas at WPR.org or 800-642-1234. Dr. Bates, you have several pets. One of your pets died recently. What happened?
Well, she was a 13-year-old corgi, and I actually adopted her during the first year of my residency. I had lost another pet just before that, and my resident mates decided that I needed a new dog. So we had this little corgi come in who was going to be euthanized by the breeder because she had some medical problems, and I just fell in love with her, and, you know, I've had her for 13 years. And she had some ongoing medical problems, and she had something called degenerative myelopathy, meaning that she lost the ability to use her back legs. And so at that point, you know, her quality of life diminished significantly. So unfortunately, you know, I had to let her go, and it was very hard.
May I ask, how have you been dealing with this grief? How do you work through it?
You know, I have other pets at home. You know, I see corgis and, you know, I'll shed a tear and I'll try to remember the happy things, you know, the happy times when we went to the dog park or, you know, she herded things, the other animals or, you know, those little quirky things that she did. So, I try to remember those times, not the fact that she's gone, but sometimes, you know, you come home and they're not there or you hear something, you know, that sounds like them and, you know, sometimes you cry.
Yeah. You work a lot with families whose pets are sick. How do you mentally prepare them for the time when their pet will die?
That's a good question. And that's not always easy to do, especially in my line of work. I deal with a lot of loss or end of life. I mean, that's a big part of what I do. And I just try to be supportive as I can and to listen and to try to give owners the time that they need, and try to walk them through the process a little bit. But everyone grieves differently. So it's, you know, you just have to be there for them.
Yeah. And how do you do that as a veterinarian? Because we might think of veterinarians as, you know, doctors for pets. But you're really dealing with human beings a lot of the time.
Exactly. I mean, you're not only often a caretaker for the pet, but for the client as well. It's difficult not to care about people who care so much about, you know, these little furry family members. And so you get attached to clients just like you do their pets. And so sometimes, you know, you shed a tear, when you're going through that with them.
Do you get a lot of stories about pets at that time?
We do. And, you know, and I often encourage people to tell those stories because I think they're helpful. And, you know, when we have families there at the end of life, it's good to remember the happy times and to walk through, you know, how they came into their lives. And you really hear these stories of how these pets saved people, you know, that they came into their life at the perfect time, you know, when there may have been some life event and, you know, having that pet got them through it. And, you know, I mean, people and their pets are just amazing and wonderful.
And not only do you give them the opportunity socially to have the space to talk about pets, but you also have physical space at your facility for people to grieve. Describe that for us.
We do. I think one of the things that I'm most proud about our hospital is that when we designed it, we specifically designed sort of a consultation or a comfort room that's in a different part of the hospital, and it's away from other clients, and it's just more of a sitting type room that has soft light and music, and there's also a garden, a small outside garden attached to it as well, so people can spend that time with their pets away from other clients. They can feel comfortable becoming emotional or grieving some, and then, you know, when that time is done, they're able to leave without having to see anybody else and worry what anybody is going to, you know, think about what's happening.
Yeah. Dave from Appleton actually couldn't stay with us, but wanted to share that Dave thinks our society has different expectations for men and women and how they grieve pets. And he feels that there's a social stigma in showing that emotional loss. I mean, can grief over pets dying be a little bit embarrassing or think people will judge us for that?
I do think people feel judged in some cases. I think he's exactly right. I do think that there are social norms that have different expectations for men and women. You know, and I do hear stories of people worrying about, you know, nobody would say anything if I took the day off if a family member died. But, you know, they feel guilty about taking that time to grieve when a pet dies. And, you know, and I just try to encourage them and would encourage anyone going through that to take the time to grieve. I mean, it is really important. You can't just get over it in a day. You can't, you know, get over it in a week in some cases. I mean, that loss sticks with you and you need to just take it day by day and try to get through each day. And it's tough when you feel judged and, but I think most people that have pets, I think that most people do understand. And I think that sometimes if you just talk about it and express, that can help with the grieving process. And it can also help the people around you understand what you're going through. And maybe you don't feel so judged.
Right. And understand what you're going through and also maybe be able to open up or be braver when something like that happens in their life to be able to say, this is what's happening and it affects me. And that's fair ground.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Veterinarian Dr. Julia Bates stays with us as we are talking about grieving the loss of a pet. And this is a time for your thoughts, your ideas. How have you memorialized a much-loved pet after they died? How did you celebrate their life? We're wondering how you coped with the loss then. And, you know, when do you think of your pet now? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email your story if that's better for you. Use the address ideas@wpr.org. We're wondering if you've had a pet who died. Maybe you have a pet now and you're trying to figure out what you'll do to tell your child about that pet when they die or to talk to other family members about it. What do you remember about your pets? Now is the time, 800-642-1234. Up next is the news, and then we'll continue our conversation about how we handle grief as some of our most loved animals pass away. Up next is news. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. This is a conversation about what we lose when our pets die. They are our furry or feathered or scaly companions, and they bring us joy. Some studies even show pets help their humans with health problems from mental illness to cancer and heart disease. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Are you grieving a pet? What happened to them? Did they pass away recently, or are you mourning them years after they died? 800-642-1234 is the number to call to share your story. Dr. Julia Bates is a veterinarian, and she's taking us through the process of dealing with the loss of a pet, what we do after they die, and how we prepare ourselves before the inevitable happens. Let's go to a call now, Allison in Prairie du Chien. Allison, what's your story?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for taking my call. First, I just want to compliment your guest on having a comfort space available in their facility. I just think that's such an honorable way to provide something during the time of needing to let your pet go. The other thing I wanted to mention is that I was very lucky to have a veterinarian who walked me through the exact steps prior to having to let my pet Pusa go. But the only thing I didn't do, which I would encourage listeners to observe, is in that very last moment, right before an injection for the pet being able to go to sleep happens, I would say it'd be great to hold your pet, but don't look directly like at their eyes or at their face, because it's very obvious when the change happens. And I don't think that's the best thing to carry forward. So holding and touching and playing music and being around and talking, we were very appreciative to be able to do, but having a visual of that last moment of kind of seeing her eyes go in a way that were empty is painful.
Allison, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Oh, I'm so sorry for your loss of Pusa. I mean, that sounds so difficult. I think that you're right. I think things do somewhat change. I mean, I think we see end of life on television, which is not what happens in reality. And I try to set people's expectations that, unfortunately, you know, when pets pass, they don't close their eyes, you know, because it takes muscles to hold everything in. And sometimes when they pass, they may take what seems like a deep breath. And I just think of that as all of the energy being, you know, released. It's still that moment is still always so difficult.
What about having people, family members who love the pet in the room as you're putting them to sleep? How important is that for the pet?
Personally, I feel like it's important. I think that if people are capable of being in the room, I do encourage it, because I think that it is, you know, I believe that, you know, it's helpful for them to have their family with them, you know, at the time. So if people can, I do encourage it. And if they can't be there, we understand that. And, you know, and we try our staff, we have such a wonderful staff, and, you know, we sit with them and we hold them. And, sorry, I get kind of emotional in these things. But we try to make sure that they know that they're loved, even though their people can't be there.
Yeah. Well, it's an emotional topic, and that's why we're having the conversation about it. Let's bring in Valerie from Vernonwood. Valerie, what's your story today?
Yes, and thank you so much for having this topic. So my husband and I, we got our dog Boo Mason when he was only 6 weeks old, and he was with us until about 14 and a half. And so for the last year that Boo was with us, his health was declining. He was getting some hip dysplasia signs, and he also had he had arthritis in his shoulders. And so for the last year that he was with us, every time we would take him to the vet's office, they would just kind of prepare us that, you know, this is going to happen at some point in time. And we knew it was going to be an accident that ultimately causes it. So it was, he had a bed fall in our house. He slipped on the hardwood floor and broke his shoulder. And so we knew we had to take him in. And so we did take him to the vet's office to have him put to sleep. I just remember, and we loved our dogs more than anything in the world, but it was harder on my husband from that point and even going into, like, the weeks than it was for me, and which upset me because I was thinking, you know, what is wrong with me? But then it occurred to me, I was watching a program on TV, and they're talking about just mourning the loss of anyone. And a thing that the actress said was that she was already in mourning prior to the point of that person or that pet passing. And I'm thinking that probably is what was going on with me. That for that last year, I was mourning him in advance of him leaving.
Valerie, yeah, thank you so much for that call. Dr. Bates, I suspect Valerie is not alone in that experience.
No, not alone. And I'm so sorry, Valerie, for you and your family. I mean, 14 and a half years sounds like, you know, you clearly were doing something right if he stuck around so long.
And from 6 weeks.
Right, 6 weeks like that. He was such a cute little yellow
fluff.
Right, fluff ball. But I think that you hit the nail on the head, you know, and I can speak from personal experience. I mean, with my own 13-year-old Corgi Bess, you know, that last year she declined as well. You know, I think you do spend that time mourning. And those are always difficult too, because, you know that things are declining and you know that the time is coming that you're going to have to let them go. And then you feel guilty for that period of time as well, you know, because sometimes it may be a fall, you know, like for Valerie's dog that caused an injury, or, you know, that they're declining and trying to pick a date to say, you know, now is the time. And that can bring a lot of guilt along with it as well, to saying, okay, you know, that today is the day. And, you know, but I think the important take home message with that is that, you know, it's difficult because we love them so much. And it's really important to remember that sometimes letting go or saying goodbye is the final act of love and unselfishness that we can give our pets.
So not assigning blame or feeling like you're at fault, but recognizing that this was the best decision for this thing that you love.
Exactly.
Dr. Julia Bates is board certified in small animal internal medicine. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about losing pets. How have you had to put your pet to sleep? What do you remember of those final moments with them? And how do you feel now? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Cindy in Lake Mills now. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
What's your story?
I had three Yorkies that each one had a different disease. My little boy had seizures. My one had a bladder condition that got infected and really tore her ability down. And the other one had a liver disease. But they were so honest and so loving. Each of them had their own personality, and they loved my one would wake my husband up when his blood sugar was low in the middle of the night. She would lick him on the nose, telling him that his blood sugar was low. And, you know, it's just so hard to lose them. My vet was excellent. They gave me time before they did anything with my pet and during my pet, you know, going to sleep. But it is hard. And I did look them straight in the eye, telling them I was so sorry for having to do this. But, you know, their life would be better now that they weren't in so much pain. I mean, my little boy laid by me during my surgeries and never moved, you know. I had to make him go outside to go to the bathroom and because he wouldn't leave my side.
That's amazing. Cindy, I want to ask, what were your Yorkie's names?
Reba, we called her, and Faith, we called her Fitty, and Smokey.
Mm-hmm.
And they were so lovable to you, and their love is unconditional. And it was very hard, very hard to put them down.
Cindy, thank you so much for telling us about your pups. Dr. Bates, how critical is it that as a vet, you're honest with the family about what's happening? Because they want the best, and they want that dog or that cat to be healthy, to
right.
have something, a quick fix that makes everything better.
Well, I think it's very important to be as frank as you can. It's, you know, it's nice if you could sugarcoat things, but especially in my line of work in particular, where I often give people a lot of bad news, I just try to be as honest and direct as I can, because I think it's really important to make those expectations the best that we can, good or bad, you know, because the more honest and direct I am with them, I think the better decisions they can make, and also to help prepare them for where things might go.
Yeah. And do people have different perspectives when, you know, when a pet dies another way than when you have to put them to sleep? Or do we grieve really similarly, regardless of the circumstances?
I think in the end, we probably grieve similarly. But I think in some of these, you know, what's really hard is, you know, if I see a pet who has been seemingly otherwise healthy, and then they acutely become very, very sick and declining rapidly. That can be a shock, or say that they have suffered some sort of trauma, like they were hit by a car or something along those lines, that they pass very quickly. I mean, that's just a shock. You're just not prepared for that. So I think it is somewhat different than declining health and making the decision to let go. But I think in the end, they're equally hard, other than the upfront shock of saying, you know, hey, I didn't expect this to happen today, and I'm really caught off guard.
Yeah, preparing for that unexpected, just a lot harder. Mm-hmm. We're talking about dealing with the death of our pets with veterinarian Dr. Julia Bates. She's our guest, and we're talking with you. Are you a parent of a child who's had a pet that died? How did you talk to your child? Did they understand? And what did you learn from the experience about your kids, or maybe about your pets, or about yourself? 800-642-1234. You can also email your story to ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues in just a moment. I'm Keely Boltina, and it's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. They're often loyal and affectionate. And even when they're not, they're still part of our families. We're talking about the effect pets have on our lives and how we can struggle to handle it when they pass away. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're taking this journey through grief with Dr. Julia Bates. She's a veterinarian who works with animals and their families. Let's go ahead and go back to the phones. Greg from Milwaukee has a story to share. Greg, tell us about your lab.
Hi, good morning. We had a lab. She was just about to turn 18, and she developed some pretty serious health problems, and my family and I had to have her put down, unfortunately. This was a few years ago. My comment was basically going back to the guy who was talking about embarrassment when, you know, you talk about grieving for a pet. I have three daughters. I can honestly say that my three girls thought of Emma, that was her name, as basically a sibling. And when my wife and I talk of her, the way we felt about her, you know, it, to me, it basically seems like a pet can be that close, have that much of a bond. I mean, we spent almost 18 years taking care of her and being her focus. We did everything for her, and that is basically like having another child. So when you lose somebody that has that much of a bond with you, it's going to affect you. It's going to tear your heart out, actually. And that's what it did to me. I was extremely close to that dog. And, you know, we have other pets now, but we always go back to remembering her. She was our first, our daughters grew up with her. And I understand when a pet passes away, how hard that can be on not only the kids, but the parents.
Yeah. Greg, thank you for that. Greg is a really great example of when a pet becomes part of that fabric of the family.
He does. And gosh, Greg, I mean, I can imagine your daughters having 18 years. I mean, that does become like a sibling. And I think that you hit every, you know, you hit all of those points and share them very well. And I appreciate you sharing your story. And it's true. I mean, so many people do think of their pets as family members or children. And, you know, people like Greg, who it's like another sibling for their children. Or there are people that, for whatever reason, don't have children, often think of their pets as family members as well. And they often reply to, you know, refer to them as being like their child.
Yeah. Let's ask Louise in Superior for their story. Louise, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
What did you want to say this morning? Yeah.
Well, I've been a practicing veterinarian for over three decades, and I've spent a majority of my career in the emergency and critical care setting. And I have obviously seen euthanasia from both sides of the table, and many more times in my critical care career than I wish to remember. But one thing that is important as a responsible pet owner, I think, is to fully accept and recognize that one of these days we might have to make the decision to end our pet's life humanely. And that may be a decision that we're not ready to face. If we think about it ahead of time, it might make it a little easier. I'll see people come into the emergency room with unexpected illnesses or very severe trauma, and they need to make a decision relatively quickly for the benefit of the pet, because the pet is suffering severely. So it's not a bad idea to have a little bit of an advanced directive talk early in the pet's life. How much can we afford? What are our values? What are we able to handle physically and emotionally at home for the care of this pet if it becomes critically ill? Because you might be dealing with a doctor you've never met, you don't know, you don't trust. In that emergency care situation, you're very emotional. What are some guidelines to help make that decision for the benefit of your pet?
Yeah, Louise, thank you for that idea. Dr. Bates, thinking about how far you'd want to go before you're in a situation where a pet is acutely hurt or just has a chronic illness.
Yeah, I think the doctor has made some good points, and I think that they are good things to talk about. What I have seen, though, is certainly there are clients out there that they think they're going to do one thing, you know, and they've talked about it and they think that's going to how they're going to handle something. But then when they're in that situation, it's very interesting how sometimes those decisions change. So I do think that having those sort of conversations beforehand and making those, you know, considerations are super important. But be aware that, you know, you may have made that decision, but it's okay that if you're in that position, you know, that you don't have to go down that road. I mean, it becomes very emotional and kind of what we were talking about earlier in these acute things where health declines rapidly or there's been some sort of trauma. Those are difficult. When time is of the essence, it becomes difficult to make those decisions. And it would be nice if there were some sort of directive, but I think that it's you never know what you're going to do.
Yeah. Dr. Julia Bates is a veterinarian. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about our journey through grief as pets die. And let's fit in Casey in Madison here. Casey, what's your story about your dog?
Hi. I just put my Lucy down 2 weeks ago, and she had a kind of an odd hair follicle cancer that we kind of biopsied and took off, and then I knew we were just going to do palliative, and so as it came back, she wasn't showing a whole bunch of other symptoms, but I knew what was coming, and I didn't want her to feel the pain that the vet told me that, you know, when someone gets that kind of cancer. So I had to find a date to put her down before she started to feel that way, and it was excruciating because I just, even up to an hour before they came to the house to put her down, I was like, I had to make a pro and con list, and I realized the pro of putting her down was all about her, and the con of not putting her down was all about me and my fear of losing her. But so I'm just dealing with sort of a little bit of guilt, but the folks who came to the house were so good about, because they could see what was going to come, and I tried to help her that she didn't have to feel any of that. But so,
Casey,
I miss her dearly.
Yeah, what a revelation there to understand that the pros were about the dog and
right.
The cons were about, you know, her grief. We should talk, though, about the fact that she had her dog die at home, that can be an option for people.
That is. That's a wonderful gift. And there are a couple of different veterinarians that travel and do in-home euthanasias. Journeys Home is one of them. And they do such a nice job. And, and I think that everybody that I know of that has gone through that has had a wonderful experience, as wonderful as you can with losing a pet. But sometimes, you know, making those decisions, it can be helpful to have them in the home environment so the other pets can be there and be aware of the loss. And, you know, it's often more comfortable. So some people make that decision. And, you know, if you have that opportunity, it can make a big difference and not so much the grieving process, but just feeling like it's a much more comfortable environment.
Dr. Bates, we've spent all of this time, you know, talking about end of life for pets. But it's clear in every one of these stories how much these animals have mattered to people, how they have changed people's lives and been there with them. So, I mean, we have to ask, when is the right time to look at possibly getting a new pet after yours dies? I mean, how can you know?
That's a good question. And I don't think that we do know. You know, some people will go out right away because they feel like they need to fill that void. You know, other people say, I'm never getting another pet because I can't go through this again. And I think in many of those cases where people swear off getting pets, I think they find down the road that you know, they may be ready for one, or maybe one just comes into their life. I was down to one dog and two cats. I had previously had five dogs and five cats, and when I lost my most recent pet, just a month or two later, another dog happened to come into my life. So I wasn't looking, and there she was. So,
what a wonderful way to end it. Thank you so much, Dr. Bates.
Thank you.
Dr. Julia Bates is a veterinarian. She's board certified in small animal internal medicine and practices at Madison Veterinary Specialists. Madison Veterinary Specialists is a sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.